Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of Augustus, The Life of Rome's First Emperor, by Anthony Everett, narrated by John Curlis, and directed by T.G. Reynolds. This book is copyrighted 2006 by Anthony Everett. This recording is copyrighted 2006 by Recorded Books. Few figures in history have had more influence on the course of human events than Caesar Augustus. Plucked as an inexperienced teenager from his studies to take center stage in the drama of Roman politics, and assisted by two school friends, Agrippa and Maecenas, Augustus's rise to power began with the assassination of his great uncle and adoptive father, Julius Caesar, and culminated in the titanic duel with Mark Antony and Cleopatra. As Rome's first emperor, Augustus transformed the unruly republic into the greatest empire the world had ever seen, and his consolidation and expansion of Roman power 2,000 years ago laid the foundations for all of Western history to follow. And now, Augustus.
Preface. Imperator Caesar Augustus, to give him his proper title, was one of the most influential men in history. As Rome's first emperor, he transformed the chaotic Roman Republic into an orderly imperial autocracy. His consolidation of the Roman Empire 2,000 years ago laid the foundations on which Europe, both as a region and as a culture, was subsequently built. If anyone qualifies as the founding father of Western civilization, it is Augustus. His career was a masterly study in the wielding of power. He learned how to obtain it, and more important, how to keep it. As the history of the last 100 years has shown, empires are hard won and easily lost. In the 1st century BC, Rome governed one of the largest empires the world had seen, but through foolish policies and bad governance, risked its collapse. Augustus devised a political system that enabled the empire's survival for half a millennium. History never repeats itself exactly, but today's leaders and students of politics will find his policies and methods to be of interest. Yet Augustus himself is a shadowy figure. Many books have been written about his achievements, but they have tended to focus on the Augustan age rather than on the man as he was. My hope is to make Augustus come alive. As well as narrating his own doings, I place his story in his times and describe the events and personalities that affected him. Shipwrecks, human sacrifice, hairbreadth escapes, unbridled sex, battles on land and at sea, ambushes, family scandals, and above all, the unforgiving pursuit of absolute power. Augustus lived out an extraordinary and often terrifying drama. The stage is crowded with larger-than-life personalities. The brilliant and charming Julius Caesar, the ruthless Cleopatra, who is often said to have used sex as an instrument of policy, the idealistic assassin Brutus, the intelligent drunkard Mark Antony, the dour Tiberius, the great but promiscuous Lady Julia, and many more. The incidents and actions that make up a life cannot be fully realized without also conveying a sense of place. So I have sought to evoke the main locations of Augustus's career, as they were at the time and as they appear today. Among them, his house on the Palatine, the secret palace on the island of Pandateria, the low, sandy headland of Actium, and the spectacular city of Alexandria. The Roman world is still recognizable to us who live 2 millennia later. The day-to-day practice of politics, the realities of urban living, the seaside resorts, the cultivation of the arts, the rising divorce rate, the misdemeanors of the younger generation, past and present, have many things in common. However, certain forms of degradation, slavery, the low status of women, and the gladiatorial carnage of the arena shock and astonish us. So too does the moral approval accorded to military violence, and imperial expansion. Julius Caesar's largely unprovoked conquest of Gaul was hailed at Rome as a wonderful achievement. But it is estimated that 1 million Gauls lost their lives in the fighting. Augustus was a very great man, but he grew gradually into greatness. He did not possess Julius Caesar's bravura and political genius. It was that genius, of course, which killed Caesar, for it made him incapable of compromise. He was a physical coward who taught himself to be brave. He was intelligent, painstaking, and patient, but could also be cruel and ruthless. He worked extraordinarily hard. He thought in the long term, achieving his aims slowly and by trial and error. Augustus is one of the few historical figures who improved with the passage of time. He began as a bloodthirsty adventurer, but once he had achieved power, he made a respectable man of himself. He repealed his illegal acts and took trouble to govern fairly and efficiently. One curious aspect of Augustus's life is that many of the leading players were very young men. The adults who started Rome's civil wars fell victim to long years of fighting, leaving the baton to be picked up by the next generation. Augustus and his schoolmates, Maecenas and Agrippa, were in their late teens when they took charge of the state. Pompey the Great's son, Sextus, was probably much the same age when he set himself up as a guerrilla leader in Spain. Augustus died old, but throughout his long reign he never hesitated to entrust great responsibility to the young men of his family, his stepsons Tiberius and Drusus, and his grandsons Gaius and Lucius. The excitement of making one's way in an adult world must have been intoxicating. We are right to call Augustus Rome's first emperor, yet the title is anachronistic. At the time, he was simply regarded as the chief man in the state. The Roman Republic had apparently been restored, not abolished. Augustus developed a personality cult, but he did not hold permanent authority and had to have his powers regularly renewed. Only with the accession of Tiberius did people finally realize that they were no longer citizens of a free commonwealth, but subjects living under a permanent monarchy. So nowhere in this book do I call Augustus emperor. The task of writing a life of Augustus is complicated by the fact that many contemporary sources are lost, casualties of the Dark Ages. The autobiography down to 25 BC that Augustus wrote in Spain, his correspondence with Cicero, Agrippa's memoirs, the history of his times by Pollio, and Marcellus' commentaries on the civil wars after Julius Caesar's assassination, 30 books of Livy's Great History of Rome, covering the period from 44 to 9 BC. Only fragments of the life of Augustus written by a friend of Herod the Great, Nicolaus of Damascus, have survived, and Appian's detailed study of Rome's civil wars in the 1st century BC closes with the death of Sextus Pompeius in 35 BC. Dio Cassius gives a reasonably complete account in his Roman history, but his style is pedestrian, and he wrote 300 years after the event. The findings of the modern archaeologist, especially inscriptions and coins, add valuable information. Neither Suetonius nor Plutarch is a historian, properly speaking, but both inject some welcome anecdotes and personality assessments. Much more is recorded about Augustus's first 30 years than about his later life, and a thorough and coherent narrative of his youth can be constructed. However, important events of his maturity and old age call for the skills of the detective rather than the historian. Mysterious and incomplete narratives conceal as much as they reveal, and sometimes only speculative explanations can be offered. For certain years, nothing definite is known at all. Between 16 and 13 BC, we are told, Augustus was in Gaul and Germany, but we have no idea where he went or where he was at any particular time. For the second half of this book, I have been obliged to switch from straightforward narrative to a more thematic approach to my subject. This disjunction is not only due to the loss of texts, but also to a lack of governmental transparency. Once the imperial system had been established, Dio claims, most events began to be kept secret and were denied to common knowledge. Much that never materializes becomes common talk, while much that undoubtedly came to pass remains unknown. And in pretty well every instance, the report which is spread abroad does not correspond to what actually happened. That is going a little too far. Intentions are often revealed through actions, and the broad thrust of history cannot easily be concealed. However, Dio has a point. Hindsight is not open to biographers who have a duty to tell a life as closely as possible to how it was lived. I have tried not to forget that the past was once present and the future unknown, and have done my best to hide my guilty knowledge of what fate had in store for the actors in the drama. The plural of a family name that ends in US or IUS I give as I. Thus one Balbus becomes some Balbi, rather than the clumsy Balbuses. However, I am contentedly inconsistent. I allow Caesar to mutate into Caesars on the grounds that it is not inelegant, and that the correct Latin would be the pedantic-sounding Caesares. I say Pompey and Livy rather than Pompeius and Livius, because that is how the English-speaking world has termed them for many centuries. Place names are usually given in their Latin form, except for well-known Anglicisms such as Rome and Athens. To convey the otherness of not Rome, I have used Parthian and Armenian personal names in place of their Romanized or Hellenized versions. So Artavasdes becomes Artavazd, Artaxes, Ardashes, Arodes, Urud, Pacorus, Parkour, Phraates, Frahata, Phrataces, Frahatak, and Tigranes, Dikran. The modern-day interpretation of the ancient literary sources has reached a high level of sophistication, and a sceptical eye is turned, usually wisely, on any claim made by a Latin or Greek historian. I incline to a minimalist view, often accepting what I'm told unless there is an obvious or rational objection, for example, when two sources disagree. It is important to hesitate before ironing out inconsistent or surprising behaviour. Human beings are capable of harbouring contradictory emotions, of acting against their interests, or stupidly. So, for example, Augustus's reported visit to see his grandson Agrippa Postumus on his island of exile may have been an odd and foolish thing for a sick old man to do, but it does not follow that the visit never took place. Even implausibility is a criterion of judgment to be applied with caution. Most of the contradictions in this story fall comfortably inside the usual bounds of human irrationality. It is difficult to be categorical about the value of money, because the costs of providing different products and services are not the same as those of today. The basic Roman unit of account was a sesterce, very roughly worth between 1 and 2 pounds sterling. The Romans dated their years from the supposed foundation of the city in 753 BC, but it would confuse the reader if I place Caesar's assassination in 709 AUC, ab urbe condita, or from the city's foundation, rather than the familiar 44 BC. I use modern dating, and in so doing allude on almost every page to the one great event of Augustus's life about which he and practically everyone else in the Roman Empire knew nothing, the birth of Christ. Introduction. AD 14. The old man loved Capri. It was a pleasure to be back, if only for a few days. The visit would not be much longer than that, for he was about to manage his own death. Every detail had been decided. The island was mountainous and almost completely inaccessible, with precipitous cliffs sea grottos, and strangely shaped rocks. Endless sunshine, abundant, almost tropical flora, and clear air made it a lovely place, as did its delightful inhabitants, who were originally colonists from mainland Greece. Here he could forget business of state and relax in complete privacy and safety. Security was an important issue, for the old man was ruler of the known world and had many enemies. He had overthrown the partly and messily democratic republic, and for more than 40 years had governed the Roman Empire alone. He was known as Augustus, or Revered One, a name that separated him from ordinary mortals. However, he never paraded his authority. He did not like to be called Dominus, my lord, but Princeps, top person, or first citizen. Capri was not just beautiful. It was easy to defend. Years ago, Augustus had built a palatial villa here. Perched on a high promontory, it was like a ship's prow made from stone. The building contained every luxury, extensive gardens, a bath complex with hot rooms and splash pools, and spectacular views of the sea. There were no springs in this arid, rocky spot, so cisterns gathered a supply of rainwater. Four-story apartment blocks housed the many servants, slaves, and guards needed to look after the princeps and his guests. Augustus was not the only lotus-eater. He wanted his staff to have a good time too. Some of them lived on an islet off Capri, which he nicknamed the Land of Do-Nothings, because they were so lazy. Augustus was 77 and in poor health. He had noticed the first signs of terminal decline the previous spring. The end was fast approaching. So, too, was his greatest challenge. For the good of Rome, he told himself, one-man rule had to continue. So he gave careful thought to the preparations that would ensure a smooth handover of power to his chosen successor. He knew that trouble lay ahead. As soon as he died, many Romans would want to go back to the days of the free republic. People were already talking idly of the blessings of liberty. There was irresponsible chatter of civil war. The princeps set up a small succession committee, comprising a handful of trusted advisers, and gave it the task of planning the transition. The trick would be to set everything in place before anyone noticed or had time to object. He chaired the meetings himself, and he took Livia, his 71-year-old wife, into his confidence, as he always had done throughout his career. She attended some of the group's meetings. Augustus intended his successor to be Livia's 55-year-old son, an able military commander, Tiberius Claudius Nero. 10 years ago, he had formally adopted Tiberius and shared his power with him. If only, the old man thought to himself, he did not have to leave Rome to a man he did not really care for. Competent, hard-working, experienced, yes, Tiberius was all these things, but he was also gloomy and resentful. Poor Rome, he muttered to himself, doomed to be masticated by those slow-moving jaws. There was another possible pretender. Augustus had a grandson, Agrippa Postumus, now in his mid-twenties. He had always had a soft spot for Agrippa, but the child grew up into an angry and violent young man, unsuitable for public office. Nevertheless, Augustus adopted him as his son, simultaneously with Tiberius, hoping that the lad would become more mature and responsible. He did not, and his saddened grandfather had had to disown him. A few years ago he had sent Agrippa to cool his heels at the seaside resort of Sorrentum. But the boy still managed to get into trouble, and was now languishing under military guard on Planatia, a tiny island south of Elba, out of sight but, unhappily, not out of mind. This was because Agrippa had influential friends at Rome, people who were tired of his grandfather's cautious, patient style of governing. Augustus had received reliable reports that a plot was afoot to spring the boy from his place of exile take him to one of the frontier armies, and march on Rome. Any resistance during the handover of power after Augustus's death would centre on Agrippa. So the succession committee's first job was to deal with the threat he posed. In May of AD 14, Augustus let it be known that he was in need of some peace and quiet and intended to spend a couple of weeks at a villa in the countryside south of Rome. From there, he departed under condition of strictest secrecy on the long sea journey north to Planitia. Agrippa was astonished by the sudden arrival of his grandfather, and there were tears and hugs all round. But a little conversation showed that the boy was as moody and dangerous as ever. Augustus was moved, but pitiless. Right from his entry into public life at the age of 18, no one who threatened his power received any quarter. The greater the threat, even if it came from his nearest and dearest, the icier the punishment. The princeps put his arm around Agrippa's shoulders and reassured him that he loved him and would soon bring him home to Rome. He calculated that this would dampen any enthusiasm for plotting escape and revenge. Then Augustus boarded his ship, upset but glumly reconciled to arranging his grandson's execution. Everything would be much more manageable if all the main players in the succession game were out of Rome. The agreed plan was that when the time came, the princeps would dispatch Tiberius, his established deputy and heir, to settle affairs in the troublesome province of Illyricum, today's Croatia. He would be giving a clear sign to political observers that all was well, and, more to the point, that he was well. His own final destination would be his father's old villa at Nola, near the volcanic mountain of Vesuvius. If matters could be so arranged, he would die in the same room as Gaius Octavius had more than 70 years previously. This would be a dignified reminder of what the regime stood for, honouring the past and the old plain-living values of rural Italy. At last, in the summer of AD 14, the moment of truth arrived. The princeps looked and felt more ill than ever. Neither he nor his doctors knew what was the matter with him. He seemed to be suffering from no particular illness, but felt feverish and very weak. It was clear to him, as well as to Livia and Tiberius, that he had, at best, only weeks to live. It was time to put the succession plan into operation. To make sure rumour and malice did not reach the legions on the frontiers before official news came of a change of leadership in the capital, top-secret dispatches were sent by rapid courier to the commanders of the German and Danube armies and to the governors of the eastern provinces. These warned of Augustus's failing condition and Tiberius's succession. They advised strict discipline to reduce the risk of mutinies. Augustus gave Tiberius his commission for Illyricum. As a very public sign of his confidence in him, he decided to accompany Tiberius for part of his journey south down the Via Appia, the great road that led to the port of Brundisium on Italy's heel. He was held up at Rome for some days by a long list of court cases that he was judging. Losing patience, he cried, "I will stay here no longer, whoever tries to detain me." It occurred to him that when he was gone, people would remember that remark as prophetic. Eventually, the two men were able to leave Rome, accompanied by a large bodyguard of soldiers and an entourage of slaves, servants, and officials. Augustus noticed that a brisk sea breeze was rising and decided on the spur of the moment that the party would take ship that evening, although he disliked night voyages. This had the advantage of avoiding the malarial Pomptine marshes, through which they would have had to pass if travelling by road. It was a bad idea, for the old man caught a chill, the first symptom of which was diarrhoea. So, after coasting past Campania, he decided to spend a few last sunlit days at Capri. He was determined to enjoy himself. The princeps sat for a long time watching local youths at the open-air gymnasium and invited them back to a banquet. He encouraged them to play practical jokes, and they scrambled about for tokens that he threw at them, entitling the holders to small prizes, such as fruit and sweetmeats. The princeps and his party crossed over from Capri to Neapolis, today's Naples, where, although his stomach was still weak and his diarrhoea returning intermittently, he attended the athletic competition that the city staged every 5 years in his honour. He then set off with Tiberius and said goodbye to him at Beneventum, retracing his steps as arranged to the villa at Nola. Privately, Tiberius was warned not to hurry and to expect an early recall. Augustus looked at Livia. The last thing either of them expected had happened. He was feeling and looking in excellent form. She stared back at him. There seemed to be a third person in the bedroom, an almost touchable awareness of the huge, difficult thing that needed to be done. The problem was obvious. All the arrangements were in place for the princeps' death, but the princeps was recovering from his final illness. The timetable was at risk. The recently sent dispatches would soon be received. The longer Augustus lived, the more opportunity there would be for rumours to fly around Rome, and the empire, fomenting disunity and trouble, imperilling the smooth transfer of power. That afternoon, while Augustus was taking a siesta and the house was quiet in the summer heat, Livia went to the peristyle, a large cloister around an open-air garden. In the middle stood a fig tree, heavy with ripe fruit, which Livia had planted years ago. Augustus liked to pick a fig or two in the evening. Livia coated some of them with a poisonous ointment, leaving a few untouched. Later, the aged couple walked out into the garden, and Augustus picked two of the poisoned fruit and ate them. He noticed nothing. Livia ate a fig she had left alone. There was no reason for her husband to know exactly how he was going to die, she thought. Indeed, if she was lucky, he might not guess that she had had to carry out what they had unspokenly agreed. Much more pleasant for him. Augustus slept badly. He suffered from stomach cramps and renewed diarrhoea and developed a high fever. Guessing what had happened, he silently thanked his wife. In the morning, he called for a mirror. He looked terrible. He had his hair combed, and his lower jaw, which had fallen from weakness, was propped up. He gave some orders to a military officer, who immediately set sail for the island Planatia with a troop of soldiers. Hail and farewell, Agrippa. A small group of notables, including Livia and Tiberius, recalled as prearranged, gathered round the bedside. The princeps uttered some suitable, obviously unspontaneous last words. I found Rome built of clay. I leave it to you in marble. He was referring not simply to his redevelopment of the city, but also to the strength of the empire. Augustus could not resist adding a bleak joke. He had always seen life as a pretense, something not to be taken too seriously, and at his house on the Palatine Hill at Rome, he had had his bedroom walls painted with frescoes of the tragic and comic masks that actors wore. Their image came into his mind, and he asked, "Have I played my part in the farce of life well enough?" After a short pause, he quoted a well-known theatrical tag. "If I have pleased you, kindly signify appreciation with a warm goodbye." Chapter 1. Scenes from a Provincial Childhood, 63-48 BC. Velletri is a compact hill town about 25 miles southeast of Rome. It lies at the southern edge of the Alban Hills, overlooking a wide plain and distant mountains. The walk from the railway station to the centre is a steep, hot climb. Little remains of ancient Velletri, but signs of the Renaissance are to be found everywhere. In the main square stands an old fountain with battered lions spouting water. The streets leading off the piazza are roughly parallel and are gridded, echoing the original pattern of the old Roman vicai. At the town's highest point, where the old citadel must have been, a 16th-century Palazzo Comunale, which combines the functions of town hall and museum, was built on the foundations of a Roman building. Here, on a stone platform, the modern life-size statue in bronze of a man in his late teens gazes blankly from empty eye sockets into the far distance, contemplating the life that has yet to unfold. This is Gaius Octavius, Rome's future ruler Augustus. For Velaetri was his hometown, and Velaetri is proud to celebrate his memory. Gaius would recognise the lay of the land, the rise and fall of streets and alleys, perhaps the layout, certainly the views. Now as then, this is a provincial place, which seems farther from the capital city than it really is. Change has always come slowly. The community leaves a powerful impression of being self-contained and a little isolated. Even today, elderly locals squint blackly at strangers. A certain dour feeling for tradition, a suspicion of new-fangled ways, a belief in propriety, have always been typical of provincial life in towns such as Velaetri, and it would be hard to imagine a more conventional family than that into which Gaius Octavius was born in 63 BC. Every Roman boy received a praenomen, or forename, such as Marcus, Lucius, Sextus, or Gaius. Then came his clan name, or nomen, such as Octavius. Some, but not all, Romans also had a cognomen, which signified a family subset of a clan. Successful generals were sometimes awarded a hereditary agnomen. For example, Publius Cornelius Scipio added Africanus to his existing names in honour of his victory over Hannibal in North Africa. By contrast, girls were only known, inconveniently, by the feminine version of their nomen, so Gaius's two sisters were both known as Octavia. An important feature of the infant Gaius's inheritance was that, although like most Italians the Octavii held Roman citizenship, they were not of Roman stock. Velaetri was an outpost on the borders of Latium, home of the Latin tribes that centuries before had been among the first conquests of the aggressive little settlement beside a ford on the river Tiber. 200 years before Gaius's birth, Rome finally united the tribes and communities of central and southern Italy through a network of imposed treaties. The men of these lands provided the backbone of the legions and were eventually, as late as the 80s BC, incorporated into the Republic as full citizens. The little boy grew up with a clear impression of the contribution that Rome's one-time opponents were making to its imperial greatness, a contribution not always fully recognised by the chauvinists in the capital. In a real sense, the Roman Empire would be better called the Italian Empire. The Octavii were a well-respected local family of considerable means. A Vicus Octavius, or Octavius Street, ran through Velaetri's centre, just as Via Ottavia does today, past an altar consecrated by a long-ago ancestor. The family seems to have been in trade, a sure sign that it was not of aristocratic status. Gaius's paternal great-grandfather fought in Sicily as a military tribune, a senior officer in a legion or regiment, during the second war against the great merchant state of Carthage in northern Africa, 218 to 201 BC. Carthage's comprehensive defeat was the first indication to the Mediterranean world that a new military power had arrived on the scene. Gaius's grandfather, who lived to an advanced age, was well off, but had no ambitions for a career in national politics, being apparently content to hold local political office. Later hostile gossip claimed that the great-grandfather was an ex-slave, who, having won his freedom, made a living as a rope maker in the neighbourhood of Thurii, a town in Italy's deep south. It was also rumoured that the grandfather was a money changer with coin-stained hands. Friendly propagandists took a different tack and invented a fictitious link with the blue-blooded Roman clan of the same name. When he came to write his memoirs many years afterward, Gaius merely noted that he came from a rich old equestrian family. The equites, or knights, were the affluent middle class, occupying a political level below that of the nobility and members of the ruling Senate, but often overlapping with them socially. To qualify for equestrian status, they needed to own property worth more than 400,000 sesterces, and were not actively engaged in government. They were usually wealthy businessmen or landed gentry who preferred to avoid the expense and dangers of a political career. Many were contracted by the state to collect taxes on its behalf from the provinces. By the time of the boy's father, also named Gaius Octavius, the family had become seriously rich and probably far exceeded the equestrian minimum. The father, Octavius, an ambitious man, decided to pursue a career in politics at Rome, with a view to making his way, if he could, to the top. This was an extremely difficult project. The Roman constitution was a complicated contraption of checks and balances, and the odds were stacked against an outsider, a novus homo, or new man, from winning a position of authority. Rome became a republic in 509 BC, after driving out its king and abolishing the monarchy. The next two centuries saw a long struggle for power between a group of noble families, patricians, and ordinary citizens, plebeians, who were excluded from public office. The outcome was an apparent victory for the people, but the old aristocracy, supplemented by rich plebeian nobles, still controlled the state. What looked in many ways like a democracy was, in fact, an oligarchy modified by elections. The Roman constitution was the fruit of many compromises and developed into a complicated mix of laws and unwritten understandings. Power was widely distributed, and there were multiple sources of decision-making. Roman citizens, only men, for women did not have the vote, attended public meetings called assemblies, where they passed laws and elected politicians to govern the republic. These leaders doubled as generals in time of war. Although, in theory, any citizen could stand for public office, candidates usually came from a small group of very rich, noble families. If successful, politicians passed through a set sequence of different jobs, a process called the cursus honorum, or honours race. The first step on the ladder, taken at the age of 30 or above, in practice younger men were often elected, was to become one of a number of quaestors. This post entails supervising the collection of taxes and making payments, either for the consuls in Rome or for provincial governors. Then, if he wished, a man could be elected one of four aediles, who were responsible for the administration of the city of Rome. During festivals, they staged public entertainments at their own expense, so deep pockets were needed. The next position, that of praetor, was compulsory. Praetors were senior officers of state, responsible for presiding as judges in the law courts and, when required, to lead an army in the field. At the top of the pyramid were two consuls, who were heads of government with supreme authority. They were primarily army commanders and conveners of the Senate and assemblies. Consuls and praetors held imperium, officially sanctioned absolute power, although they were constrained in three important ways. First, they held office only for 1 year. Second, there were always two or more office holders at the same level. Those of equal rank were allowed to veto anything that their colleagues or junior office holders decided. Finally, if they broke the law, office holders could face criminal charges once they were out of office. On top of that, 10 tribunes of the people were elected, whose task was to make sure that office holders did nothing to harm ordinary Romans. Patricians were not allowed to be tribunes. They could propose laws to the Senate and the people, and were empowered to convene citizens' assemblies. The tribunes held power only within the city limits, where they could veto any office holder's decisions, including another tribune's. The power of the assemblies was limited. They approved laws, but only those that were laid before them. Speakers supported or opposed a proposed measure, but open debate was forbidden. All that citizens were allowed to do was vote. There were different kinds of assembly, each with its own rules. In the assembly that elected praetors and consuls, for example, the voting system was weighted in favour of property owners, in the belief that they would act with care, because they had the most to lose if any mistakes were made. The Roman constitution made it so easy to stop decisions from being made that it is rather surprising that anything at all got done. The Romans realised that sometimes it might be necessary to override the constitution. In a grave emergency, for a maximum of 6 months, a dictator was appointed, who held sole power and could act as he saw fit. The Roman Senate was mainly recruited from office holders. By Octavius's day, a quaestor automatically became a lifelong member, and he and his family joined Rome's nobility, if he was not already a member of it. Senators were prohibited by law from engaging in business, although many used agents or frontmen to circumvent the ban. In theory, the Senate held little official power, and its role was merely to advise the consuls. However, because the Senate was a permanent feature of the government, whereas consuls and other office holders had fixed terms, its authority and influence were very great. It was responsible for managing foreign affairs, and it discussed laws before they were presented to the assemblies. Its decrees, although not legally binding, were usually obeyed. The Senate appointed former consuls and praetors, called proconsuls and propraetors, Octavius was one, to rule Rome's provinces, usually for between 1 and 3 years. The equites, who, as has been mentioned, were not members of the Senate, formed a second social class, mainly comprising businessmen and country gentry. Beneath them came ordinary citizens, listed in different categories according to their wealth. The poorest citizens were capiti censi, the head count. Modern governments employ many thousands of administrators who carry out their decisions. This was not the case during the Roman Republic. There were no bureaucrats, apart from a few clerks who looked after the public treasury. There was no police force, no public postal system, and no fire service, and there were no banks. There was no public criminal prosecution or judicial service, and cases were brought by private citizens. Elected politicians acted as judges in the law courts. The consuls brought in servants and slaves from their households, as well as personal friends, to help run the government. Gaius Octavius won a quaestorship, probably in 70 BC, and joined the Senate. This was no mean achievement for a country gentleman outside the magic circle of Roman politics. The promise of political success brought with it an important benefit, a wife from one of Rome's great patrician clans. Octavius was already married to a woman of whom history has recorded nothing except for her name, Ancaria. The couple had a daughter, and perhaps Ancaria died in childbirth, for families with only one child were rare, especially if the child was a girl. Her family was of obscure origin. She may have come from Velitrae or thereabouts. She would have been no help to an ambitious young man's career and, if alive, must have been divorced. Her removal from the scene enabled Octavius to achieve a splendid alliance when he married Attia, a member of the Julian family. The Julii traced their ancestry to before the city's foundation, traditionally set at 753 BC. The legend went that when, after a 10-year siege, the Greeks sacked the city of Troy, on what is now the Turkish coast near the Dardanelles, they killed or enslaved most of the leading Trojans. One exception was Aeneas, the son of the love goddess Venus and a handsome young warrior. He escaped the city's destruction with some followers and, after many adventures, made landfall in Latium. His son, Iulus, sometimes also called Ascanius, founded the Julian dynasty. By the 1st century BC, high birth was not sufficient to guarantee political success. Money was also required, and in large quantities. The Julii were impoverished. For long generations, few of them had won important posts in the honours race. Like aristocratic families before and since that fall on hard times, they used marriage as a means of income generation. The current head of the family, Gaius Julius Caesar, was a rising politician in his late 30s, about the same age as Octavius. Talented, amusing, and fashionable, he had a voracious appetite for cash and had built up enormous debts to feed both his lifestyle and his career. One of his sisters married Marcus Attius Balbus, a local worthy from Aricia, a town not far from Velitrae. Balbus was not prominent in public life, and his greatest attraction must have lain in the fact that he was a man of substance. As a new man, Octavius knew that his dubious ancestry would damage his career. A commodious dowry would be of value in a wife, but what he really needed was entree into the Roman nobility. As a niece of Julius Caesar, Balbus's daughter Attia was well placed to make that possible. Because the Balbi lived not far from Octavius's home base of Velitrae, they may well have travelled in the same social circles. In that case, Attia formed an ambitious man's bridge from provincial life to Rome. Sometime before 70 BC, the couple married, and in due course, Attia became pregnant. Disappointingly, the outcome was a second daughter. 5 or 6 years passed before another child arrived, a son, this time Gaius. He was born just before sunrise on September 23, 63 BC, at Oxheads, a small property on the slopes of the fashionable Palatine Hill, a few minutes' walk from Rome's main square, the Forum, and the Senate House. By tradition, the paterfamilias held the power of life and death over his household, both his relatives and his slaves. When a child was born, the midwife took the infant and placed it on the floor in front of the father. Should the father wish to acknowledge his paternity, he would lift the baby into his arms if it was a boy. If a girl, he would simply instruct that she be fed. Only after this ritual had taken place did the child receive his or her first nourishment. Apparently, Gaius was lucky to survive this procedure, for an astrologer had given him a bad prognosis, and he narrowly escaped infanticide. If Gaius had been rejected, he would have been abandoned in the open air and left to die. This was a fate to which illegitimate children and girls were especially liable, as were, one may surmise, sickly or disabled babies. Rejected infants were left on dunghills or near cisterns. They were often picked up there by slave traders, although the family might reclaim the child later if it so wished, or, more rarely, rescued by a kindly passerby. Otherwise, they would starve, unless eaten by stray dogs. Rome, with about 1 million inhabitants, was an unhygienic, noisy, crowded megalopolis, no place for rearing a child, and there is evidence that Gaius spent much of his infancy at his grandfather's country house near Velitrae. More than a century later, Suetonius reported that the house still existed and was open to the public. A small room, not unlike a butler's pantry, is still shown and described as his nursery. Helped by the link through Attia to Julius Caesar, Octavius's political career was advancing rapidly. After serving as quaestor, he could move up to the next rung as one of the 4 aediles. The aedileship being optional, it is not known whether Octavius held this office, but he could probably have afforded it. At the age of 39, Octavius was eligible to run for praetor. According to Velius Paterculus, he was regarded as a dignified person of upright and blameless life, and was extremely rich. In the Praetorian election for 61 BC, he came in first, even though he was running against a number of aristocratic competitors. The two-year-old Gaius would have seen little of his father, who spent a year in Rome discharging his judicial duties as praetor. Then, as was usual for senior government officials after their period of office, at the end of 61 BC, Octavius went overseas for a 12-month stint as governor, or propraetor, of the province of Macedonia. Octavius was due to sail from Brundisium, a major port on the heel of Italy, but before he did so, the Senate asked him to make a detour to the town of Thurii on the Tho and disperse a group of outlawed slaves. More than 10 years previously, these men had joined the great slave revolt of Spartacus, following him during the years when he won one victory after another over incompetently led Roman legions. They managed to avoid the terrible penalty exacted on the survivors of Spartacus's final defeat. Thousands were crucified along the length of the road from Rome to Capua, where the rebellion had started at a school for slave gladiators. Somehow, the escapees managed to keep going as a group, re-emerging briefly to join the forces of Lucius Sergius Catilina. In the year of Gaius's birth, this dissident aristocrat had plotted the violent overthrow of the Republic and its replacement by a regime of radicals which he would lead. The alert consul, Marcus Tullius Cicero, was a new man like Octavius. A fine public speaker and an able and honest administrator, he outwitted the conspirator and finessed him into a botched military insurrection. The Romans depended on, but also feared, the hundreds of thousands of slaves who in large part ran their economy, providing labour for agricultural estates and manufacturing businesses. Slaves could also be found in every reasonably well-off home, cooking, cleaning, acting as secretaries and managers. If they were young and good-looking, slaves of either sex could well find themselves providing sexual services. A slave was something one could own, like a horse or a table. In the Roman view, he or she was a talking instrument. Slaves could not marry, although they could make and save money and could receive legacies. If a master was murdered by a slave, all the slaves in his ownership were killed. It was believed that a slave could give true evidence only under torture. Perhaps a third of the population of Italy were slaves in the late Republic, as many as 3 million people. For Octavius, dealing with the surviving Spartacans was an important task. They did not pose a great threat in themselves. It was the principle that counted. No rebellious runaway should be allowed to enjoy the fruits of his illicit freedom. As a victorious general, Octavius could acquire an honorific and hereditary title, and it seems that he added Thurinus to his name to mark his defeat of the slaves, passing it on to his infant son. Suetonius, writing in the 1st century BC, asserted, "I can prove pretty conclusively that as a child Gaius was called Thurinus, perhaps because his father had defeated the slaves in that neighbourhood soon after he was born. My evidence is a bronze statuette which I once owned. It shows him as a boy, and a rusty, almost illegible inscription in iron letters gives him this name." The truth is that Octavius was making himself slightly ridiculous, for the defeat of slaves conferred no great honour on the victor. In adult life, his son was often insultingly referred to as the Thurian. The new governor of Macedonia administered his province justly and courageously, and won a high reputation in leading circles in Rome. It was clear to all that despite his provincial origins, Octavius was well qualified for the top job in Roman politics, the consulship. But in 58 BC, when he must have been only in his mid-40s, he died unexpectedly en route from Brundisium to Rome, before he had a chance to launch his candidacy. It is not known what killed Octavius, An accident of some kind is a possibility, although one would suppose that the ancient sources would have mentioned that. He died in his bedroom at a country villa belonging to the family that stood on the slopes of Mount Vesuvius, a fact that suggests illness. Most probably, he fell victim to one of the many health hazards in the Roman world. One of these was food poisoning. Stomach upset was among the most common recorded complaints, and analysis of Roman sewage deposits suggests that certain intestinal parasites were often endemic, borne by bad fish and meat, among other sources. Despite the growing availability of fresh water brought in through aqueducts, standards of sanitation for most people were low, although the rich were able to afford separate kitchens, underfloor heating, domestic bathhouses and private latrines. Few understood that human waste matter could spread disease. Oil lamps and open hearths or braziers generated irritant smoke, which caused and spread respiratory infections. Epidemics of all kinds regularly swept through Rome as a result of overcrowding, and the fact that the capital of a great empire witnessed a continual influx of visitors, traders, and returning government officials and soldiers. Gaius was only 4 years old when his father died. In addition to the sadness of his loss, his premature death will have caused a family crisis. Domestic life was rigorously patriarchal. A widow, especially one of independent means, was often expected to marry again at the earliest opportunity, although if she remained true to the memory of her dead husband, she would deserve praise for being a univira, a one-man woman. This may not always have been easy for a woman of a certain age with a growing family, but Attia was still young, and her connections made her highly eligible. A year or two after Octavius's death, she landed another apparently rising politician, Lucius Marcius Philippus, an aristocrat who proudly claimed descent from the royal line of Macedon. He had just returned from Syria, where he had been provincial governor, and he stood successfully for one of the two consulships of 56 BC. He backed his brother-in-law, Julius Caesar, as Caesar climbed the political ladder, but only cautiously so. Unlike his dashing ancestors, the Macedonian King Philip and Philip's son Alexander the Great, who conquered the Persian Empire in the 4th century BC, Philippus was temperamentally risk-averse, a neutral who preferred diplomacy to commitment. After his father's death, little Gaius seems to have been brought up by his maternal grandmother, Julius Caesar's sister, in whose house Attia may well have passed her brief widowhood. That he stayed with her after his mother's remarriage is a little odd. It could be explained by mutual affection or by Philippus's lack of interest in a small stepson. It may have been in this house that he first met his famous great-uncle, Julius Caesar. Romans of high social status took very seriously the education of children, and especially of boys. During his early years, a boy was looked after by the women of a household, but once he reached the age of 7, he usually passed into the control of his father, whose duty was to instill in his offspring the qualities of a good man, a vir bonus. High among these were pietas, loyalty and a due respect for authority and traditional values, gravitas, a serious, sometimes over-solemn, approach to the challenges of life, and fortitudo, manliness and courage. A son was expected to learn by observation. He helped his father on the land, and, wearing his smart little toga pretexta, an all-enveloping cloak-like garment with a red stripe indicating the wearer's childhood status, trotted around after him as he went about on public business or conducted religious ceremonies. In this way, the boy would learn how the political system worked and how grown-ups were expected to behave. It is not clear who, if anyone, played this paternal role for the orphan Gaius. For a time, a friend of Octavius, one Gaius Turanius, was the boy's guardian, but he left little mark. We know that the adult Gaius did not value him highly. However, Atia won a reputation as a strict and caring mother, even if she was not always directly involved in her son's day-to-day supervision. One positive masculine influence is recorded. A slave called Spherus was Gaius's attendant during his childhood. He seems to have been much loved. He was given his freedom, and when he died many years later, his charge, now adult and famous, gave him a public funeral. Boys from affluent families were sometimes taught at home, but many went to private elementary schools, ludi literarii, which inculcated reading, writing, and arithmetic. Girls might also attend, but their schooling ended with puberty, although they were trained in the domestic arts by their mothers, and some received private tuition in their teens. It is probable that Gaius attended classes in Velitrae or Rome, accompanied by Spherus. Teaching methods were painstaking, but hardly inspired, a matter of imitation and repetition. The school day opened with a breakfastless dawn and ran on into the afternoon. No attention was paid to games or gymnastics. Fathers looked after boys' physical exercise. But the long hours of instruction ended with a bath. Pupils had to learn the names of the letters of the alphabet before being shown what they looked like. They chanted the letters all in order, forward and backward. They then graduated to groups of two or three letters, and finally to syllables and words. In about 51 BC, when Gaius was 12, his grandmother Julia died. It must have been a sign of their closeness that the boy was given the signal honour of delivering a eulogy at her funeral. The invitation is also evidence that he was growing into a self-possessed and clever teenager, who was likely to acquit himself well. He addressed a large crowd and was warmly applauded. Gaius at last moved into his stepfather's household, where both Atia and Philippus took his secondary education into hand. He attended a school run by a grammaticus, a teacher of literature and language, the staples of the curriculum. Both Greek and Latin were taught, but literary studies centred on the Hellenic inheritance, the epic poems of Homer, the Athenian dramatists, and the great orators. There was a Latin literature, but it was rough-hewn and heavily dependent on Greek paradigms. As Cicero dryly put it, "We must apply to our fellow countrymen for virtue, but for our culture to the Greeks." The teacher specialized in textual analysis, examining syntax and the rules of poetic scansion, and explaining obscure or idiomatic phrases. The student learned to read texts aloud with conviction and persuasiveness, to master the art of parsing, that is, breaking a sentence down into its constituent grammatical parts, and to scan verse. This form of schooling had a long life. It survived into the Dark Ages and was reinvigorated in the Renaissance. As one modern commentator has observed, there was not a great difference in the teaching of Latin and Greek between early 19th century Eton and the schools of Imperial Rome. The grammaticus also introduced the student to rhetoric, the art of public speaking. Most upper-class Roman men were destined for a career in politics, so the ability to persuade people to adopt a course of action or entertain an opinion was an essential skill. But oratory was held to be more than a talent. It conduced to the leading of a good life. The statesman and moralist Cato the Censor defined an orator as a good man skilled in speech. Apparently, Gaius showed great promise. If this is not a later invention, boys ambitious for a political career used to go around with him when he went out riding or visited the houses of relatives and friends. Like the adult senators who used to walk through the city accompanied by crowds of dependents, Gaius was attracting young adherents whose support would be returned, they hoped, by help, whether now or in the future. This will have had less to do with his charm or intelligence than with the fact that he was related to Rome's most powerful politician, Julius Caesar. Gaius made two special school friends, very different from each other in personality. The first was Marcus Vipsanius Agrippa, a year younger than Gaius. The origins of his family are unknown, but Suetonius says that he was of humble origin. The name Vipsanius is highly unusual, and Agrippa himself preferred not to use it. He may have come from Venetia or Istria in northern Italy. Like the Octavii, the family was probably of affluent provincial stock. According to Aulus Gellius, a collector of curious anecdotes and other unconsidered trifles, the word Agrippa denoted an infant at whose birth the feet appeared first instead of the head. Breech births were difficult to manage and could endanger the mother's life. It is said that Marcus was born in this perilous manner and was so named in memory of the event. Gaius's second friend, Gaius Silnius Maecenas, boasted a distinguished ancestry. He traced his lineage to the splendid, mysterious Etruscan civilization, based in today's Tuscany, which dominated central Italy before the rise of Rome. The Etruscans were believed by some to be immigrants from Lydia in Asia Minor. Maecenas was of regal stock, descending on his mother's side from the Silnii, who many centuries before ruled the Etruscan town of Aricium, today's Arezzo. By the 1st century BC, though, the family had come down somewhat in the world. They were now Equites. If one may judge by their later careers, Agrippa was likely a tough, down-to-earth boy interested in physical exercise and warlike pursuits, while Maecenas had a more pacific, even feminine temperament, and was especially interested in literature and the arts. They grew into adulthood alongside Gaius, learning to accord him total trust and forming a lasting, loving bond with him. As his teens proceeded, an able upper-class adolescent moved from his secondary school to the ancient equivalent of a higher education. Leading politicians would often house writers and thinkers in their capacious homes. Young men were able to spend time there, learning from conversation and watching the political career of their host. As a form of military service, they would also join the staff of a leading general. For most of his life, Gaius had seen little or nothing of his astonishing great-uncle, Julius Caesar, who had spent 10 years conquering Gaul. Soon, the triumphant general would be back in Rome and able to provide the eager teenager with the most remarkable introduction to the twin arts of politics and war in the history of Western civilization. That finishing school finished off the Roman Republic for good. Chapter 2. The Great Uncle, 48 to 47 BC. The year 49 BC saw the world turned upside down. The Roman Republic was facing catastrophe, thanks to a civil war in which one of the protagonists was Gaius's great-uncle. What were the causes of the crisis? It was partly the product of stubborn political, military, and economic facts, and partly of colourful but obstinate personalities. It was also the inadvertent outcome of astonishing success. As the patricians and the plebs fought for constitutional mastery, Rome's legions slowly fought their way through Italy in war after war, until they controlled the peninsula. After a titanic struggle with Carthage in northern Africa, the Republic emerged as a Mediterranean power by the beginning of the 2nd century BC. From then on, Rome increasingly acted as an international policeman, sending its legions to right wrongs in foreign countries, especially the Hellenistic kingdoms of the Middle East. Invited to intervene by some Greek cities, it vanquished Macedonia and eventually annexed it as a Roman province. It went on to defeat Antiochus, king of Syria, who unwisely challenged Rome to a fight. In 133 BC, the king of Pergamum, in today's western Turkey, died, leaving his kingdom to Rome which renamed it the province of Asia. The Republic was now the leading power, not only in the western Mediterranean, but also in the Middle East. It commanded an empire stretching from Spain, which it had inherited from the Carthaginians nearly a century before, to western Turkey. A band of client kingdoms marked the boundary with the Parthian Empire, today's Iraq and Iran. The triumph of Rome has puzzled historians down the centuries. Of the many factors that accounted for the city's emergence on the world stage, the most important was that from their earliest beginnings, Romans lived in a permanent state of struggle, with their enemies abroad and with one another at home. Tempered in that fire, they became formidable soldiers, as well as learning the political arts of negotiation, compromise, and anger resolution. Flexible and skilled at improvisation, they developed a practical imagination. They usually tried to settle a dispute, if they could, without violence. But when military force became necessary, they applied it with a ruthless vigour. Three important consequences followed Rome's emergence as a superpower. The first was a huge influx of wealth and slaves. Direct taxation for Roman citizens living in Italy was abolished. The lives of the ruling class became more and more opulent, the frequent festivals and gladiatorial games increasingly elaborate. With the opening up of foreign markets, cheap grain flooded into Italy, driving the native smallholder out of business and replacing him with large livestock ranches, often run with slave labour. The rural unemployed fled to the big city, which became yet bigger. Unfortunately, the job market could not expand to soak up the refugees from the countryside. The authorities began to provide free grain to quiet a febrile and uncontrollable urban population. Second, to manage such extensive dominions demanded substantial military forces. In the old days, country smallholders were called up to fight short campaigns as and when necessary. Now, standing armies were required, with soldiers serving for long periods. These soldiers depended on their generals to persuade the Senate to allocate farms to them when they retired, either in Italy or further afield. These farms would be their pensions. Largely as a result of conquest, the state owned a good deal of land. However, rich landowners, among whom were many senators, had quietly appropriated much of it without payment. These noble squatters were, to put it mildly, disinclined to disgorge their ill-gotten gains. So the legionaries depended on their generals to bully, finesse, or persuade the Senate to free up land for their retirement farms. They developed a loyalty to their generals rather than to Rome. The third consequence of empire was the strain that its administration placed on the ruling class, and indeed on the Republic's constitution. So large was the throughput of elected officials that it is hardly surprising that their caliber was variable. A good number were corrupt and incompetent. Many Romans believed that their traditional virtues of austere duty and healthy poverty were being eroded, and that this decadence explained the growing violence and selfishness of political life. The picture was not quite so bleak as it was depicted, for some nobiles worked hard to maintain standards. However, others did live in extravagant, irresponsible, and self-indulgent ways, and it was they who set the tone.
This ends Disc 1.